Dr. R.J. Rushdoony, R.R. 163 Before, Ethics and History, Contemporary Cultural Ethics, What is the World Coming to?
Is Ethics and History. In a sense, this is very closely related with what we dealt with this morning when we considered in the other class permanence and change, because we were there also concerned with history. And our subject this afternoon, in a sense, is an extension of our subject this morning. A very common statement that we encounter regularly as we talk to clergymen and laymen is that eschatology does not matter. That it doesn't make any difference whether you are post-millennial, and I'm putting that first with malice aforethought, or amillennial or premillennial, as long as you believe that the Lord is coming again. In fact, I had one minister, a very fine man, very outstanding man, tell me that he was pan-millennial. Unfortunately, what you are saying, if you say that eschatology does not matter, is that no philosophy of history is necessary for a Christian. And that is a radical surrender of a vast area of life to the enemy. Because a philosophy of history is important. Time is a creation of God. The history of this world was ordained by God, and we have a commission in terms of that history. It is therefore important we know what God's purpose is, what God's plan is in history, how He plans to have us function, what His program for the development of events within history and at the end of history means. As a result, we cannot avoid an eschatology without avoiding a philosophy of history. And if we avoid a philosophy of history, we are then saying we have surrendered the vast areas of ethics in favor of a pietistic conception of ethics. That our ethics are limited to an exclusively personal domain. When we do that, we have abandoned the Reformed faith. Because the Reformed faith is emphatically a world and life view. This was something that at the very beginning even Rome recognized. It recognized that the course of Christian history was going to be determined in terms of a conflict between Rome and Geneva. And the more far-seeing thinkers within the Roman communion see the basic problem still as between Rome and Geneva. Because they recognize that here was a totality of a faith, of a theology, a philosophy. That it was not just a matter of saying justification by faith and truncating the faith there as Luther did, so that his perspective was a seriously limited one, great as it was within that domain, but limited. What the Reformed faith gives us is a world and life view. We cannot therefore neglect the subject of eschatology. Now, Calvin never did write on Revelation. The concerns of the Reformers were strictly limited to very contemporary issues, and they did not have the opportunity to deal with all problems, and there are gaps in their ability, having only one lifetime in which to work, to write commentaries on everything and to consider every subject in full. But there is no question that John Calvin, in particularly his commentary on Isaiah, does manifest an eschatology. A postmillennial eschatology, let me add. But nonetheless, he has there clearly set forth a philosophy of history. And it is precisely because of this that Calvin and his followers had a world and life view. They had a program. And it was reformed armies that were on the march in Europe in terms of a world and life view. It was reformed ministers who were on the march to bring one area into captivity to Christ after another. So that whatever the area of life you look at, it was the reformed thinkers. It was the Puritans in England who were the basis of the Royal Academy developing scientific thought. They were the foundation of the new sciences. In one area after another, it was reformed men, reformed scholars, reformed statesmen that exercised leadership. And it was because of the default of other groups who lacked a philosophy of history. And today, the collapse of so much Christian power is in part due to the lack of a philosophy of history. It is due to the fact of pietism, which has restricted the domain of God to the soul of man. Now, the soul of man is an important domain. When God commands it, it's the starting point. But we cannot restrict it to that any more than we can say when a child goes to school, now look here, the beginning of education is the ABC, so spend your life majoring in the alphabet. No. We learn the alphabet as small children in order that it can unlock the whole world of learning for us. So it is that the soul indeed is the starting point in order that it might unlock the whole world of the new covenant, in order that we might move out in terms of God's program, God's plan to exercise dominion in one area after another. The denial of God's lordship of history and the pietistic perspective means ultimately that personalism is, for most of reality, the basic fact. Dr. Van Til has commented, and I quote, this is from his Christian Theistic Ethics. We may say that all believers in Christianity will, if they see the implications of their position, be opposed not only to determinism, but also to indeterminism, as these terms are usually understood. Both determinism and indeterminism place man in an impersonal environment from which God is wholly excluded. In contrast to this, we must, as Christians, think of man as a creature of God. And this is of the utmost significance for the proper conception of his freedom. It implies that man's freedom consists in doing of his own accord the will of God. It implies that there was nothing in man's environment or in man himself that would force him not to do the will of God. Unquote. Now, this is a very important point. I don't know how many of you have read Charles Norris Cochran's Christianity in the Classical World. How many of you have? That's sad. And I trust you will get it. It is available in paperback. It is one of the most important books written in the past 50 years. Written by a classical scholar, not a Christian, and yet a most eloquent testimony in spite of itself to the Christian faith. Because what Charles Norris Cochran, in compelling fashion, declares in that book is this, and Dr. Van Til, incidentally, was one of the earlier readers and was the one who informed me of its significance so that I read it very early. The Greco-Roman world affirmed the freedom of man. No God up there controlling man or predestinating man. So they affirmed a radical freedom on the part of man, his free will. But, says Cochran, as against the Greco-Roman emphasis on the free will of man and against the early church's emphasis on the predestination of man by God, it was the early church who produced the free man. It was the early church and the predestinarians who were the champions of freedom. Why this contradiction? Well, this was the problem. In the Greco-Roman worldview, man as an individual was surrounded by a vast ocean of chance, of brute factuality. This brute factuality overwhelmed man in his solitary freedom here. It crucified him. Because all the factors in this brute world of factuality, being random, overpowering factors, bore down on man. The stars determined him. Heredity determined him. Environment determined him. His parents determined him. His education determined him. His society, his political order, you name it, they determined man. So man, with this radical freedom of will in an ocean of brute factuality, ended up a hopelessly determined creature. But man, created in the image of God and predestined by the sovereign counsel of God, as set forth by the church fathers in terms of Scripture, moved now in a world which was totally predestined by God, in which he himself was totally predestined, but in which he had, as a creature created in the image of God, a secondary freedom, a secondary causality, so that he was not determined. He was God's free man. So you had the amazing paradox in all the controversy back and forth between the early church fathers and the pagans. The pagans insisting on the free will of man, ending up by concluding man was totally determined and being totally pessimistic, seeing no hope for man. And the Christians affirming God's predestination and ending up by being the champions of man's freedom. Delivering man, you see, from this world of environment, of heredity, of the stars, of politics, and saying, no. These things do not determine man. As a consequence, he says, intellectually, the classical world collapsed. It was a failure. It could not stand up to the arguments and to the witness of the early church. So that philosophically, the victory went to the church fathers. Let me state again the title of that book, because it is eminently worth your while. Charles Norris Cochran. C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E. Christianity and Classical Culture. It was originally published, and I think almost certainly still is, by the Oxford University Press. Now, of course, this is precisely the problem that modern man faces, that which Cochran described of the world of the early church. Existentialism today seeks to assert the radical autonomy and the radical freedom of man. It says that man is so totally free that his own, that he does not even have a subconscious or an unconscious, so that there is nothing outside of him nor anything in his own being that can determine him apart from his rationality. But all that is left in the domain of the personal is man. So man is a lone island in the cosmic sea of meaninglessness and nothingness. And as this lone island of the personal, of the ethical being whatever he chooses to do, being his own God, determining good and evil for himself, is very easily and very readily overwhelmed by that world. The odds are too great. Man who is born to die, but whose passion is to be God, how is he going to assert himself in the face of this? Dostoevsky gives us in The Possessed, literally the title of that novel is The Demon Possessed, the strange figure of a Nietzschean person, Kirillov, who has determined that man is God. And how is he going to eliminate? How is he going to eliminate the threat to his deity? Because death poses it. So he can affirm as against death, which is going to bear down on him someday, that I am indeed God. And Kirillov concludes, the only way I can do it is to say, it is not the gods or God or fate or time that is going to take my life away. I will declare myself God by making it my will. I will commit suicide. And he does. That was the logic, of course, of existentialism. And a French dramatist of the new drama, the far-out drama, a few years ago chose the same course. And he decided to do it dramatically. It was too quick with a gun. He sat down and proceeded over a period of a very reasonably short time to drink himself to death, making a witness all the time that this was his goal. And it was his way of witnessing that he affirmed himself against God and against the universe, that he, the person of a new God, of his own free will, said, life to me is nothing. I choose death, and thereby I declare myself God over my being. That, in a sense, epitomizes humanism. It is suicidal. In a futile gesture, it affirms its independence, and it can do nothing except to kill itself. But in the process, having limited the domain of the personal to the lone figure of man, and having said that the ethical is that which I choose to do, so that the ethical has no relationship to the outside world. It is only myself in my own being. It also witnesses to the death of the ethical. Because the ethical is overwhelmed. It has no meaning in a cosmic sea of meaninglessness. And man must say, I too must die. And therefore, ethics dies with me. The absolute dies with me. But for us, unless we are pietists, for us, unless we are hostile to biblical eschatology and will not set forth our eschatology, the domain of the personal is not limited to God. Every fact every fiber, every atom, every hair on our head is the personal creation of the absolutely sovereign and personal God. So that every fact in the universe is a totally personal fact. Now when I sit at the table in my dining room and look around the room, I do it with a real satisfaction and pleasure, with a pride. Because I look at the things that I have and I thank God for them and that He's given me the privilege of having the possessions I do, and I look at a picture on the table and I remember it's a very personal thing, that picture, when my wife and I chose it. And I look at a piece of furniture and I remember why my wife decided she wanted it and what she likes and doesn't like about it now that she has it. And I could look around the house at the pictures and I can see the feelings that I had when we got that painting, or remember the artist who gave it to us and so on. And everything in the house is very personal. It represents a part of the experience of my wife and myself as we accumulated those few things and our delight in them. So that none of those things are impersonal to us. And of course, as a real estate agent remarked once, one of the hardest things to do is to get people to sell a home they live in for many, many years and in which they've reared their children, and to do it realistically, knowing the value thereof in objective terms, because they look at it and they say, you know, my kids slid down that banister and had so much fun, and I scolded them so often for doing it, and now I wish I could see them do it again. Or it was in this room that a little girl died, and so on. Everything has a meaning to them, a very personal meaning. There's nothing impersonal about that house because they've lived with it. Well, that's only a fragment of personalism. When you realize that God, in His infinite wisdom, created all things in terms of His personal will and purpose, a totally self-conscious God. There is no unconscious or subconscious in God. And the wisdom and majesty of His creation, so that there is not a single needless detail or atom or hair, but all in terms of His sovereign purpose, have a meaning that staggers us. Because it is so total, so omniscient, we must say, the universe is a totally personal universe. Totally personal. All facts are personal for God. So that we cannot limit the scope of God and His ethical word to our own soul. It covers everything. This is why in the scriptures and the law of God says, the earth is mine. Therefore, He proceeds to give His law. And Moses declares, the earth is the Lord's. Therefore, when you go out into the camp, carry a shovel with you, so that when you have to use the earth for toilet purposes, you cover it, because this is God's word, His moral word, that you be mindful of His earth. When you besiege a city, you do not destroy the fruit trees in the area. That's a sin. It's a violation of God's purpose, God's moral word governs our use of the earth, of trees, of people, of all things. Hence it is that his is the total word, the only word for history. Anything but a biblical position, because it reduces the world of the personal to man, must reduce the world of morality to man. And with that, it collapses, because man then is overwhelmed by the impersonal. And man, being then meaningless, very quickly is hardly a matter of moral concern. We must therefore say that if you forsake the doctrine of God as creator, you very quickly forsake a philosophy of history, and you have no moral concern about history. This is why, for example, the concern of modernism with history, the social gospel, is less and less a moral concern all the time. And it's a technological concern, a socialist concern, because it reduces history to impersonal factors, and therefore it places the blame not on man as sinner, but on institutions, on capital, or on parents. It will have a Marxist, or a Fabian socialist, or a Freudian, or what have you, orientation, not a moral orientation, a sociological or a psychological orientation, which is anti-ethical, which is a form of determinism, having denied the predestinating counsel of God and affirmed the radical autonomy of man, it ends up by leaving man determined by his environment. Thus the modernists lose any moral concern with history. They surrender history. Only where you have the totally personal God who is totally the creator do you have a totally personal universe. This is why, of necessity, biblical law is God's word for the whole of life. God, as Lord, must govern all things. You cannot have a theology without having a theonomy. And very soon, I trust, one of our Chalcedon books, Greg Vonson's study of theonomy, will be available. It's a very important work. But it is time we concerned ourselves with theonomy, with God's law. Because if we affirm him as creator, if we affirm a philosophy of history, we must inescapably have a theonomic concern. We cannot be, in our philosophy of history, humanists and still be Christian. We cannot look to man as the source of law there and still continue to affirm the sovereignty of God. Thus, ethics is definitely concerned with the domain of the personal. We'll agree with the pietists there. The pietists are right. The domain of morality is the domain of the personal. But what we must say is that the domain of the personal is to be identified not in terms of man, but in terms of the sovereign God. And therefore, the domain of the personal is all-inclusive. And hence, we have a universal word from the universal God. Are there any questions now? We have several minutes. Yes.
You made a comment a moment ago about how this liberal was increasingly concerned with the technological and modern moral sense.
Yes.
Into that sort of area, what would you think of a man like Scarfield, who would say a technological atheist, where, you know, he's documenting almost what the autonomy of machines and all of that talk about here?
Yes. Jacques Ellul is essentially neo-orthodox, and as a result, as he faces this impersonal world, which is in a sense a creation of his philosophy, he's horrified by it. He wants the domain of the personal. So he reacts hysterically against this, and he becomes an anti-technological man. So in a sense, he says, I want to outlaw this whole world. Which is no answer at all, you see. He wants to roll back progress. There's a professor, I believe, at Dartmouth who came out with a book a couple of years ago in which he espoused the abandoning of all technology, of allowing most of the United States to revert to its original state, and for us to live like Indians on the boundaries of the new forest that would be created. Now, Jacques Ellul by no means goes that far, but he is a part of that same kind of reaction. Now, the answer to Jacques Ellul is that this technological society is not to be cast aside. You've rendered it as an impersonal thing because you've withdrawn God from the world, so that if you abolish technological society, you're going to still face the world of nature as a similar impersonal juggernaut. It's not going to be any different, because that's what it was to pagan man. Exactly the way you view the technological world, so pagan man viewed the natural order. Yes, another question. Yes.
Could you say a few words about
Yes. Eastern thought is very popular with us today, and it's tragic that it is, because what they are looking to in Eastern thought is really the collapse of Eastern thought. Now, Eastern cultures were far, far ahead of Western in antiquity. No question about it. They came to grips with the problems, and they've been suffering from the consequences since, whereas Western society has only lately come to grips with the problems. They were faced with a problem of how to deal with the problem of the one and the many, the problem of particularity and oneness, with the problem of, is the world to be seen monistically or dualistically? And they pushed very logically and consistently in their philosophies the dialectical tension either into an ultimate dualism or an ultimate monism. In either case, they destroyed meaning. But it was logical. Now, Western thought stopped short of that over and over again and tried to maintain the two in dialectical tension. But the dialectic keeps breaking down either into monism or into dualism. So Western thought has not been as successful. And now as it's collapsing, naturally it's reaching to the collapsed status of Eastern thought and saying, aha, there's something that's similar to what we want. But Eastern cultures have been paying the price of their logical thinking in terms of these factors through the centuries. And what these men are trying to do is to reproduce that same failure. This is why Eugene, or in German, Eugen Rosenstock Huessy, one of the most brilliant thinkers of recent years, a Dartmouth sociologist, spoke of John Dewey's thought as the Chinification of America. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm not sure. In your introduction, you talked about eschatology and dealing with the subject of ethics and history. It seems you studied Calvin, and I haven't read all of Isaiah, but in book two of his Institutes, it doesn't seem like it's his eschatological perspective of post-millennial, but he does seem to have a view of ethics and history under the sovereignty of God and functioning under the moral law. So my question, I guess, would be, what was your point on eschatology? And it doesn't seem to me, if the point was you had to have a proper perspective or then how would that tie into Calvin?
Yes. Granted that in Calvin's day, the issues were not as sharply focused, I would still say yes, Calvin was a post-millennial. I think Dr. Bonson could tell you more there, because he has traced the history of eschatology quite extensively, and he has a forthcoming book on Revelation, which will be a landmark study, the most thorough and the finest study of the subject yet made. And he will deal with Calvin's views therein quite extensively. Yes.
In your textbook, Secular Authority always told us that certain civilizations are naturally more important than others. On a Christian philosophy of history, what basis do you use to question on this?
Yes. Your opening comment, I think, is very interesting. You said secular historians tell us certain dates are more important than others. They do this until they come to the logic of their position. A few years ago, at a major university, a professor of history began his course with this statement that history is nothing but myth, there is no meaning to history, no significance to it, and all the histories written and taught are pure mythology. But he said, the state is paying me a fairly good salary to teach you history, so let us proceed. Now, he may have been cynical, but he was honest, you see. Once you destroy any plan, any philosophy of history, then every date is equally meaningful and equally meaningless. In terms of a biblical philosophy of history, we have our basic pattern here. It gives us the development of history from creation to Christ to the second coming. And everything has significance in terms of that. And things are peripheral if they are not directly related to that. Let me illustrate that. I spent, as some of you know, 8.5 years on an Indian reservation. I think I know a great deal about the Indians and their problems and their weaknesses, but I'm very fond of them. I really enjoyed being with them in spite of the gravity of the problems and the difficulty of the work, because Indians are perhaps next to Muslims in being the most difficult people to evangelize. I could talk to you by the hour with a great deal of pleasure on Indians. I have a collection of Indian artifacts that are a real source of pleasure and pride to me. But I think it's ridiculous that today, as a part of our sentimental humanism, children are getting so much in many schools as a part of their curriculum on Indian life and culture. Far more than they ever get on Christ, on the Bible, and on the history of the faith. You see. Now that's pure irrelevance. I may for myself find meaning in Indian history and life because I have a personal involvement, a personal fondness. And one of my six children is adopted and he's Indian. But this doesn't give it significance in terms of writing a history. If I sit down and write a history of America or of the world, a world history, I have to deal with it in terms of progress of God's plan. And what belongs in that history is what has relevance to it. For example, if I may take a minute more to develop it, the Council of Chalcedon or Chalcedon is, I believe, one of the most important events in history. In the year 451, the whole idea of the state as a divine human order, as the incarnation of God, was shattered by the fathers at the Council of Chalcedon. William Carroll Bark and other scholars who are rarely heard from see it as the beginning of the Charter of Freedom for the Western world. But how many of you ever heard about it in history as you read it? Or the significance of the legal revolution wrought by Justinian and Theodora. I'll be dealing with that tomorrow afternoon at 4. That's a commercial. Tremendous. It's the most important thing in the history of the Western world. Today, we have a revolution against what Theodora wrought. But they don't tell us that. And all you get in the textbooks, if you find anything, is slander concerning Theodora. Now, you would deal with these facts in a Christian history. You would give priority to those things rather than to what our textbooks do at present. So you'd have a radically different perspective. Any other questions? Greg?
Maybe I can get you to comment on one point before we make a closing announcement. Some have asked me, aside from class, Mr. Rush, to me, about your views of American history and the this morning you humored us with the War of Northern Aggression and your moral interpretation of what's called the Civil War, and that your views on the supposed revolution in America. I wonder if you might take just a couple of minutes to explain why you call that a counter-revolution.
Yes. The term is not mine. It was coined by an Austrian scholar, Peter Drucker, who, by no stretch of the imagination, would be on our side, basically. But nonetheless, he called it a conservative counter-revolution because its basic premises were very definitely in terms of the colonial Christian tradition. It was not a revolution. It was a war of independence. Moreover, it's an ironic fact that the pamphlets that were used in that war against the British were used by the South against the North, and as a result of that, they just took and crossed out the name George III and substituted the federal government in Washington, D.C., and they used some of the same pamphlets. And that's why our whole interpretation of the War of Independence was radically altered from there to the present. Now, there's so much that could be said, but in essence, colonial culture was Christian to the core. Up through the 1820s, 30s, and 40s in this country, the Bible was the common law of the land. Juries and judges decided cases not out of statute law, but out of the Bible. The whole purpose of the Constitution was to limit the right of the federal government to intervene in the life of the states and of the peoples and their religious establishments, so that it was Congress that was prevented from any establishment of religion. The states could have them, the counties could have them. Most of the states had an established church, 9 of the 13 in the beginning. The other 3 had Christianity as the establishment. It was a matter of state option, whether they would have an established church or an established establishment of Christianity as such rather than the church. Now the issue in the war in 1860 was not so much slavery. That was a pretext. Slavery had become a problem to the South as well as the North. The only southern state that was pro-slavery was South Carolina. That may come as a surprise, but remember, one out of 18 southern whites only was a slave owner. Only one out of 18. The other 17 resented slavery. They resented it bitterly. Most of the slaves, moreover, were non-productive. It was a welfare system. As a matter of fact, Dabney, one of the greatest theologians this country has ever produced, a tremendous man, by the way, very delightful, said that slavery was a form of communism, and he was anti-communist. But he said what the federal government in Washington and what the unions and the corporations in the North were producing was a more vicious form of slavery, and that's why he was going to fight them. He said, incidentally, of the corporations that the trouble with them was that the corporations have no soul to be damned nor a backside to be kicked. Now, Dabney was right. The issue then was centralism. And it was a means of foisting centralism. You see, every time you have a war, you increase the power of the central government. And the basic drive of those who were for the war, who were basic to it, and to forcing the issue, was a desire to foist centralism on the country as against the power of the constituent units, the states. And so slavery was the convenient issue because here they had a built-in situation they could exploit.
I encourage anybody who wants to pursue historical interpretation.
Authorized by the Chalcedon Foundation. Archived by the Mount Olive Tape Library. Digitized by ChristRules.com.